There's something happening here. But what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I've got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
Welcome home to Passionate Justice 72. Thank you all for your continuing growing support. So pleased more and more of you are following the show on Twitter for all Passionate Justice news, releases, podcasts. I ask all of you, follow the show at JWOLF41387 on Twitter, at JWOLF41387 on Twitter. Now a new hour. Personal notes, great guest writers spurring you on every week, every day a new chance to create a little more justice in our world. And I want you to join. I want you to join our salon, the very best readers and writers site on the net, growing and hosted by Lori Wright. And it's free. Join now at www.oursalon.net. I am author, activist, Jonathan Wolfman, the spark for these stories, Passionate Justice, a progressive memoir and essays, available at Amazon, and I'm proud to say, so very proud, underwriting for Passionate Justice in 2015 comes from Bud Clayman and OC87 Productions, producers of OC87, RecoveryDiaries.com, and the feature-length film, OC87, the obsessive-compulsive major depression bipolar Asperger's movie. I want you to check out OC87, recoverydiaries.com. I want to open today with a very important program note and a request that could put you, yeah, you, on the radio. You know, every politician worships our vets. Until the moment they're elected, and then most politicos are pleased, very pleased, to forget our veterans' real long-term needs until they run for re-election. But we at Starcom note that we're in the run-up to the 40th anniversary of the fall of Saigon. See, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter where you stood as to the wisdom of that war. If you're honest, you'll agree that the Viet War vets have been treated shabbily. Starcom can't make up for the neglect of government administration upon administration, but we can do this. On April 30, 2015, our morning show, Upfront and Outspoken with Bob Williams, will be doing a very special tribute to all of our men and women who served in Southeast Asia, and you can be a part. If you've a personal experience you wish to share for our tribute, please now email Bob Williams at kkrp1610@yahoo.com, kkrp1610@yahoo.com, and in the subject line, write VET, V-E-T. And again, we want to share your Vietnam story, so do write us at kkrp1610@yahoo.com. Thank you so much. Now, you are going to recall our North Carolina friend, collaboration writer Kosh. Here's a letter he wrote to his own senators, signers of the letter to the Iranian mullahs. Kosh wrote, "I've been asked to sign petitions protesting the letter from 47 senators to the government of Iran. I'm not signing. I'm not signing. Instead, I'm contacting your office. Regardless of what you think of our president, the U.S. government should speak to other nations with one voice. I'm 60 years old, and I've never seen the Senate undermine a sitting president like this, and I do pay attention. If a Democratic Senate had done this to a Republican president, you and your colleagues would be screaming for their heads, and I would join you. You are setting dangerous precedents. Please set limits. Please set limits on how far you'll let your antipathy for this particular president take you. I also objected to the invitation to Prime Minister Netanyahu to address Congress without informing the White House beforehand. I say that as a Jew and as a staunch Zionist. As an American, I found that out of line. You have told the world it's fine to ignore a president of the United States, which means you've tied the hands of his successors. Regardless of what you think of the man, he was elected to the office twice. Thank you for your attention. And now Kosh goes on to share the following with us. This letter to the government of Iran was a terrible idea for all sorts of reasons. It increases the probability of war, decreases the probability that Iran will give access for nuclear inspections, gives Iran an excuse to ignore United States. They can now say, and this is on the letter signers, it's really on them, that they can never know who to deal with in Washington. What bothers me most about this is what's been bothering me for quite a while about the Republican Party and its current incarnation. They just don't respect process. I started to see this phenomenon during the Clinton years when Prosecutor Ken Starr was going after President Clinton. He issued a subpoena to Presidential Detail Secret Service officers at the time the president was seeing Monica Lewinsky. This, of course, means that future presidents will not be able to trust Secret Service agents when discussing sensitive matters that could put the life of a future president at risk. Starr's action was so far over the line that former President George H.W. Bush took a stand in public at the time opposing Starr's action. Get your man. Screw the fallout. That's all you care about? We saw some of that during the following Bush administration, most glaringly in the Valerie Plame case. A man criticized the administration, and in retaliation, his wife, an active CIA agent with operatives still in the field, was outed. Had Ms. Plame been outed in such a manner by the Clinton administration, President Clinton would have been impeached, perhaps tried for treason. During the Obama administration, it has gotten much, much worse. The tradition enabling Congress to govern with the White House starts with the honeymoon period where Congress holds its fire while they figure out how to work with a new president, usually about 100 days. This tradition was the first to go, with the Senate minority leader, the then minority leader, saying immediately after the inauguration that job one, his words, job one, was to keep this president from being reelected before they had any evidence as to how he'd govern. And it wasn't just rhetoric. Respect for opposition was, for all practical purposes, forbidden. A congressman shouted, "You lie!" at the president during a televised State of the Union address. The filibuster was repurposed as a tool to minimalize normal business in Congress. Republicans in Congress came dangerously close to putting the U.S. into default, threatening not to spend funds in ways that Congress, with both parties having voted, had already allocated. Such a default would have meant millions in extra interest payments to banks with nothing to show for it, nothing. Sheer waste, with enormous profits going to banks. And how do you win elections? The old way was to get more votes than your opponent. The new Republican way is to disenfranchise as many opposition voters as possible. I mean, now, gerrymandering is not new, though the Republicans raised it to an art form in 2010, but voter ID is new. This technique involved taking a numerically trivial problem and fixing it with a solution that is several orders of magnitude worse than the problem it pretends to address. And we're talking about fixing very loosely, as we've leading Republican officials in two states, at least on record, as saying the real purpose of voter ID is to keep Democratic voters from the polls. Now we've moved into foreign policy. Now Republicans are using officials from other countries in an attempt to embarrass our president. The secret invitation to Prime Minister Netanyahu drew condemnation from prominent Republican supporters, including Forbes magazine. The letter to the Iranian government is frankly worse. Now nearly half of the United States Senate has announced to the world that the President of the United States does not speak for the United States government. I cannot begin to fathom this. Try to imagine this being done to Richard Nixon while he negotiated with Brezhnev over arms limitation, or Mao over the opening to China. Try to imagine this being done to John F. Kennedy while he was responding to Cuban missiles. Imagine this being done to FDR during the Second War at Yalta or Potsdam, negotiating with Churchill and Stalin, and the Senate sends them both a letter saying, oh, don't listen to Roosevelt. This is the United States presidency, not an individual president we're talking about. Ask yourselves, what is partisanship worth? I can think of several adjectives. I can think of several adjectives that apply to the letter from 47 senators, but there's one that absolutely does not apply: patriotic. And you know, as I thank Kosh for this, I have to say, I think war with Iran is precisely what these sock puppet senators and their neocon puppet masters want. I just think they ought to have the sack to say it. Now, you know, when we discuss race, it's so often in terms of our tense present or fraught past. A writer new to Passionate Justice, Kingston, New York's Mary Lois Adshead, speaks to the future of race in her piece, Cool Plus Colored Equals Cool Minus Colored. Mary Lois says this: I watched TV one morning seven years ago and saw an astonishingly beautiful young woman singing a shocking song. I waited till the credits and learned it was none other than Beyoncé. I should have known. Whatever hip is, I'm not it. Seeing this elegant icon sent me back to my high school days in Alabama. We had a girl in class move to town from Chicago and started telling us about a book she'd just read, stating the premise that by the year 2000, there'd be so much in her marriage that there would be no separate races. Everybody would be beautiful beige, share the most attractive physical characteristics of all races. Said she couldn't wait to see that day. Now, needless to say, life hasn't happened as predicted. Now, don't forget the time and place she was reading it. This was Southern Alabama in the 50s. We'd never seen an interracial couple. I just assumed the Negro race came in many shades, from light brown to dark chocolate. Someone remarked of a light-skinned black, he must have a lot of white blood. And that did not compute in my isolated lily-white teenaged mind. I hadn't been told where the white blood might have come from. Nowadays, it's so cool to be black that many with very little black blood claim that is their ethnic group or race. Yet watching, hearing Beyoncé I was struck by how close we're coming to the day of the melding. Look around you at the beautiful people beginning to surround us, the cool people. A mix of colors, ethnicities, their stars rising from actors like Terrence Howard, Halle Berry, to the President of the United States. The cool colored people are gaining on us whites. The number of good-looking, talented, of mixed racial background is notable and growing. We'll change our world in less than a generation. The day hasn't quite come, but it's drawing closer. Look around. You know, the Tea Party takeover of Mr. Lincoln's party is a flailing last-ditch, people, and ultimately hopes reaction, because they have, as Mary Lois has said, looked around, and they're so damned afraid of the loss of power and privilege that they've always seen racially and only in racial terms. But you, as we hurtle toward a USA in which whites are a minority, with Mary Lois, you can and must embrace our new world. Now, from our friend, Canadian poet Mary Sears, a new piece, Soundless Rage. Soundless rage drags its gnarled fingers deep across one's soul, drawing blood. Such is the depth of this anguish. How do the feeling, thinking, and deeply caring survive in this mad world? How does one keep from bleeding out? How does one keep sane? Soundless rage scribbles and screams, calling out its pain. But the slogans demanding freedom and justice have all been forgotten and erased. Some see nothing. Others see all, some feel nothing, others feel everything. We, the feeling and seeing, must band together, grow stronger in numbers, ensuring decency stands a chance. Soundless rage dictates that our souls and minds are the nails that keep one rooted, keeping up the fight. One day we will come to lose, and all could be lost. Oh, Mary Sears is such a fine poet, and her poetry in so many ways defines passionate justice. Now, Sean King at Daily Kos explores some of the context of the SAE fraternity's booting from the University of Oklahoma campus, and I promise you, you haven't heard this background. Sean calls his piece a deeper examination of the sheer joy of Oklahoma students chanting about hanging niggers from trees. Sean writes, "Money during a bad economy doesn't actually disappear, it just moves around to different hands. If a whole segment of America all of a sudden doesn't have money because of shifts in the economy, just means that it's shifted to another group. But understand, the money still exists, just not in your wallet. Racism's like money. Changes hands, shape shifts, finds itself a new carrier, a new account, a new way to express itself in changing times, but it never actually disappears. Suppressed racism is no less real than money in a savings account, yet suppressed racism always has a way of outing itself, sometimes in the most despicable, hurtful, shocking ways." Before I dig into why a group of white University of Oklahoma College students from the Sigma Alpha Epsilon fraternity clad in tuxedos and ball gowns so giddily chanted out about hanging niggers from trees, let me be clear. Racism is dangerous. It's not funny. It's not simply words. It's not kids being kids. It's not playful. It's dangerous. Racism is the fundamental dehumanization of an entire group and has consequences. When college students on a bus chant about not letting niggers into their fraternity, but instead hanging them from trees, it not only reveals the heart of those singing, it gives us a real clue as to how easy and even joyful it is for them to imagine lynching. If we choose to ignore the clues that people give us about how they feel about our humanity, we bear at least some of the weight of the results. Your words do reflect your heart. They do reflect your mind, your words. These young people are telling us in certain terms what they truly think and feel about black folk. That's why when it was discovered that the captain of the Ferguson Police Department, the sergeant, and the desk clerk at the court in Ferguson all engaged in sending outrageously racist emails, that their extreme record of racist treatment of African Americans made so much more sense. They will never be a nigger in SAE. There will never be a nigger in SAE. You can hang him from a tree, but he can't. He'll never sign with me. There'll never be a nigger in SAE. Yeah, it's disgusting. Just 27 days earlier, however, people on Reddit were talking about this same chant. 27 days, almost a month earlier, people on Reddit were talking about this same chant, stating that it was a required chant to enter the SAE fraternity, not at Oklahoma, but at the University of Texas. Before the controversy at the University of Oklahoma, it was done at Texas. But even before that, SAE had demonstrated a history of racism across the United States. So what we're talking about here is not isolated racism made up on the go by a group of hateful rednecks. The chant has real roots in this frat. These are college students in suits on their way to corporate America declaring not only the racial segregation of their fraternity, but their outright hatred for African Americans and their vision of America itself. Giddy happiness by whites at black pain and misery. It's not new. Seeing these young people with such fervor talk about lynching niggers from trees, it has roots. You'd be hard-pressed to find lynching photos of African Americans without smiling white faces. The night after their sickening video was released, a frat member defiantly put on his window a Confederate flag in spite of the reality that Oklahoma was never in the actual Confederacy. Doesn't feel that way. This was a celebration. This was a celebration. Bring the kids, bring your girlfriend, smell the death in the air, strike a pose, take a photo. If you can stand it, you'll find an overwhelmingly happy white face in every lynching photograph. Why the smiles? Why the smiles? What makes this moment so special? What made the men and women in these archival lynching photos so happy is the same spirit that makes college students chanting about doing it feel so great about life for a moment. In the most carnal way possible, the deep misery of another reminds them of just how privileged they are. And it feels good. Let me say that again. For a moment, in the most carnal way possible, the deep misery of another reminds these people of just how privileged they are, and it feels good. And let me add here, for those of you who imagine that this is isolated, I want you to know this. 4 years ago, where? At Cornell University. Cornell University closed down its chapter of Sigma Alpha Epsilon SAE. Many members of the frat left the school altogether because why? Why? They just killed a man, George Desdunes. George Desdunes, an aspiring doctor. He was a 19-year-old sophomore from Brooklyn. He was the son of Haitian immigrants. His hands and feet were tied with duct tape and zip ties. Blindfolded, he was given so much alcohol, he died within a few hours of the hazing, all alone and completely unconscious. He was found dead by a college cleaning crew the following morning. His mother filed a $25 million wrongful death suit in the case, and on its own, the hazing death of George Desdunes is tragic, but when viewed in light of the recent racism that has been exposed within the SAE frat, you know, you have to, one has to, when a popular fraternity chant song has violent lines about lynching black men? Oh, for God's sake, don't you get it, people? When a popular fraternity chant has violent lines about lynching black people, don't you get it? It means everything's on the table. And to those of you who might say that people who object to this behavior are somehow weak, just can't take it, should take it, and shut up. Well, let me ask you this, and this is me. This is not Sean. This is me. Let me ask you this. Would you be this quick to say that if a national black fraternity, if a national black fraternity had beaten to death a white kid, had been caught in a video with the same song but substituting the words rich cracker trash, subbing that for nigger and smiling, that be okay with you? We will be right back. Welcome back to the second half of Passionate Justice 72. I ask you, I do, right now, follow the show on Twitter at jwolf41387, at jwolf41387 on Twitter. And yeah, join, participate for free in the best readers and writers site on the net, www.ursalon.net. Now, you may know that New Jersey and California and Washington, D.C. have made illegal the long-discredited reparative therapy, or what sometimes is called conversion therapy. Yeah, they've made it illegal, and it's good news, too, not only because there's no evidence whatsoever that being gay is a choice and no evidence that being gay is an illness to be cured, but also it's good news because the frauds, you see, who have made money on this, they prey on scared parents who've been so scared many times that they've forced their kids into this crackpot fake medicine. And, you know, here comes more good news from the Human Rights Campaign, HRC. Liz Halloran reports that Psychology Today, we've all seen Psychology Today, it has agreed, finally, to reject advertisements from practitioners of this so-called conversion or reparative therapy. They say that today we welcome the decision, that is the HRC, the Human Rights Commission, the Human Rights Campaign, welcome the decision by Psych Today to stop accepting online listings from mental health practitioners who offer to so-called cure LGBT people. In a letter last week to the leadership of Psychology Today, HRC requested that they stop publishing such listings and to build on the publication's history of LGBT inclusion, and also post an article condemning the use of harmful conversion therapy. In a statement issued today, that is just last week, Psychology Today said that it does not endorse or publish ads for reparative therapy, and that going forward, all professionals listed in their branded online directory of therapists had been notified that those who offer such therapy in their profiles will be delisted. That's good news. So-called conversion therapy is a dangerous and discredited practice that puts vulnerable people, particularly kids, at terrible risk. Not only is there no evidence that a person's sexual orientation or gender identity or expression can be in any way cured, but research also shows that attempting to do so can lead to depression and suicidal thoughts, and again, particularly in the young. In February, HRC became aware that a California-based marriage and family therapist was advertising conversion therapy services on Psychology Today's website, and such therapy is based on the vicious idea. I want you to think about this. It is based on the vicious idea that being LGBT is a mental illness that needs to be cured. A concept, you want to know what? This is a concept that's been rejected for 40 years by every major medical group in the United States. California and New Jersey, along with the District of Columbia, have laws protecting young people under age 18 from this lunacy, and numerous states are currently considering similar legislation. If you think your state should be as wise as California and New Jersey have been, you know what to do. Now, hop that Jefferson airplane with me and be a volunteer of America again. Jump on in where? Jump on in to Marietta, Georgia, just northwest of Atlanta, and I want you to meet the organization Voice Today, and its founder, Angela Williams, a child protection advocacy organization hot off a terrific victory in Georgia. The organization, with others, is responsible for the Georgia House passing the Hidden Predator Act, House Bill 17, which now moves on to the Georgia State Senate. The bill passed overwhelmingly. Folks, listen to this vote. It passed 169 to 2. Now, what is the Hidden Predator Act of Georgia? It's a step forward in giving victims of child sexual abuse their opportunity to have their day in civil court. We should, and I sure as hell do, we should applaud the Georgia House of Representatives for making childhood sexual abuse a priority. The primary aspects of the bill in its current form allows for, first, a 2-year discovery rule which permits a survivor of child sexual abuse who has been locked out of the courts due to short civil statute of limitation to unlock courts to seek justice going forward after July 1st of this year, just a few months from now. And second, it offers a 2-year revival window for civil claims that were time barred from the courts against the perpetrator. That window will open on July 1 also, and it will close on July 1st, 2017. So it's a 2-year window. And the window applies only to the perpetrator. And it allows, third, for a victim to have open records where they were the subject of an investigation, so this can be used as evidence against the perpetrator. See, current Georgia law restricts victims of child sexual abuse from having access to their record. Can you imagine that? Do you think your own state, wherever you live, restricts victims of child sexual abuse from having access to their own records? What in hell is that? Many victims spoke out at the Capitol expressing their concern for the rights of child rape victims during the hearings, and Angela Williams, advocate, child rape victim herself, and founder of Voice Today, she says she's encouraged. She says, "I'm grateful that the Georgia House of Representatives are creating the way to give victims of child sexual abuse a voice in their day in court," and she looks forward to working with the Georgia Senate to make the bill an even more victim-friendly measure, as I said, it now having passed the House, it moves on to the Georgia State Senate, and currently, you see, Georgia is ranked among the worst states for child sexual abuse victims' rights. But this bill, once it gets passed, this bill can move Georgia into a leadership role. The passage of this bill puts Georgia, Angela says, on a new legal footing, becoming a state that is truly for liberty and for justice, not just for some, but for all. Child sexual abuse is pandemic in our society. Did you know, people, that 1 in 4 girls and about 1 in 6 boys are sexually abused by the age of 18? Well, it's true. And I have to ask you, if you're are you interested in helping? If you are, I want you to contact Angela Williams at Voice Today in Marietta, Georgia. Here's the phone number, 678-644-5589. Voice Today's number again is 678-644-5589. And I want you to take a look at their terrific website, www.voicetoday.org. And you can write directly to its director, Angela Williams, at angela@voicetoday.org. Now, here's a question for you that I bet you're not asked every day. Want to outfit your own army with as many working AR-15s as you want for, oh, say, about $1,200? Raw Stories' Scott Kaufman tells you how. A gun rights advocate has invented a 3D printer that will allow amateur gunsmiths to create AR-15 assault rifles without serial numbers or the hassle of a background check. Earlier this year, Cody Wilson demonstrated that anyone could use a 3D printer to print a gun. He says if 3D printing means anything, if the digital revolution and the 3D printing revolution have any interesting terminus, it's because we will all have access to greater means of production, just like these cameras and computers that we have enable us to become cultural producers, so too with material things, and that must, of course, include guns. Well, that's what Mr. Wilson says. According to the site Wired, his new project in do-it-I-yourself gunsmithing is even more ambitious. Now he's using a PC-connected milling machine dubbed the Ghost Gunner, to print the component of an AR-15 rifle called the lower receiver. The lower receiver is the most heavily regulated component of the AR-15, as it's the body of the gun that connects all of the assault rifle's other parts. For $1,200, Wilson's company, Defense Distributed, his company's called Defense Distributed, it'll sell anyone, a computer numerically controlled mill that will allow them to print the lower receiver, and they can then purchase the other less regulated elements of the AR-15, such as the stock, magazine, barrel, from online gun shops and create a fully functional automatic weapon that contains no serial number and requires no background check. These weapons, you know, are sometimes called ghost guns, hence the name of Wilson's Mill. Selling such guns is illegal. I'll say that again. Selling such guns is illegal, but selling the means to produce them or the means to making one, that's not illegal. Typically, Wilson told Wired that this has been the realm of gunsmiths, not the casual user. This is where digital manufacturing, the maker movement, changes things. We developed something very cheap that makes traditional gunsmithing affordable. You can do it yourself at home. This is a way to jab at the bleeding hearts. It's about humiliating the power that wants to humiliate you. Well, that's what Mr. Wilson said, and his new project is a direct response to the so-called ghost gun ban bill introduced by California State Senator Kevin DeLeon. The bill would criminalize using a 3D printer to print or finish a lower receiver without a government serial number. This wouldn't be worth doing if Kevin DeLeon didn't know about it, Mr. Wilson says. So, within a short time, for $1,200, you stop being an armchair, sackless general, and you can go commando, rule your own army. But wait, there's more. If you can spit up just over 1,000 to make as many military assault rifles as you like? Well, perhaps in a few years, you'll be the first lunatic on your block to print your own nuclear arsenal for not much more. Now, here's a piece from a writer who calls herself Megita in Daily Kos. And she calls it forced births, bad old days. She writes, when I was in college, I was part of a group of women. I was part of a group of women who maintained access at women's clinics when anti-abortion protesters were trying to block women seeking abortion, contraception, and, ironically, prenatal care. We'd go to any of the LA area clinics where we heard the anti-abortion protesters were. We were of various ages from many neighborhoods, but standing outside, putting our bodies between the protesters and the women patients, we got to know each other very well. I got to know a woman called Judy. Her story has always haunted me. She was born in 1950, Judy was, to an East Coast Irish Catholic family. Her father worked outside the home. Mother, with six kids, kept house and raised the children. Her extended family was huge. When she was 12, her mother's brother, 10 years older than Judy, began to molest her. Like a lot of girls of that time, Judy didn't really understand what sex was, let alone what was happening to her. She liked the attention, but also felt very ashamed and had no way of talking to her mother about what was going on. At 13, she started getting sick, not just in the mornings, but all day long. Her mother took her to the doctor, who examined her and realized that Judy, who had not yet actually gotten her first period, was pregnant. The doctor and her mother questioned her, and the truth of what Judy's uncle was doing with her did come out, and Judy remembers the doctor being very kind to her and telling the nurse to talk with her mother. He left the room, and the nurse made it clear that there was an option other than childbirth, should they want it. Judy recounted how her mother said she thought that would be the right thing, but that they would have to pray about it. From the doctor's office, Judy and her mother went to their parish priest. Her mother tearfully recounted what the doctor had said and what Judy said had happened. Her mother was afraid that if her husband found out, that he'd kill her brother. She told the priest about the other option the nurse had told them was possible, and at this point the priest, who had been kind and comforting up to this point, became cold and even harsh. He said that what the nurse had been alluding to was an abortion, which was both illegal. This was 1963, 9 years before Roe v. Wade, and a mortal sin. There was no way it could be considered, he told Judy, and she was not to tell her father how she got pregnant, that if she did, she would be responsible for her father hurting or even killing her uncle. Judy would be sent to St. Anne's, a Catholic maternity home for unwed mothers in a city about 50 miles off. Having her baby and the child itself would be put up for adoption. Judy didn't understand everything that her mother and the priest were discussing, but she knew she didn't want to be sent off. She didn't want to be sent away and didn't want to have a baby, and she was, of course, terrified. She begged her mother to do anything to let her stay at home. The priest told her and her mother there was nothing else they could do and assured them both it would be all right. Judy was upstairs when her mother told her father she was pregnant and wouldn't say how it happened. Judy's father yelled at her mother but never demanded Judy tell him how she had gotten pregnant at 13. When she was telling me the story, she said she didn't know how she would have answered him had he asked. It just wasn't a conversation she could imagine them ever having, and besides, she wasn't entirely sure how she had gotten pregnant. Her body and sex were outside her 13-year-old's understanding. Judy did know, however, with a burning passion, that she didn't want to have a baby and didn't want to be sent away from her mom. She kept pleading with her mother to take her back to the nurse, that the nurse had promised to help. When that failed, Judy tried to kill herself and the baby by throwing herself down the stairs. She succeeded only in breaking her arm. At that point, she was sent away to St. Anne's, where she lived until her baby was born. Because she was suicidal, she was watched all the time and not allowed above the second floor. And then she was moved to the ground floor. She was not allowed to be alone with anything long or sharp, but did try, after talking with some of the other unmarried girls, to self-abort by pushing her hand as far inside herself as she could. And she was caught, and so caught she was made to sleep tied down to the bed. She was sick throughout her pregnancy and kept in bed most of the final months. And the birth itself was an agony. Her mother wasn't there. She was among strangers. The pain was so terrible. Screamed until the doctor put her under. When she woke, the baby was gone. She was told the child was a boy. She told the nurses she didn't want to see him. He was taken away. And she was told he had been adopted. After she recovered, she was sent home. Her pregnancy and the baby never discussed, never felt close to her mother again. Judy left home the week she graduated high school and moved across the country from her family as far away as she could get. She never went home again and never spoke to anyone in her family, didn't go home even for her parents' funerals. In the 80s, her son tried to contact her through an attorney, but she refused the contact, not wanting to tell him he was the product of a rape, incest, and forced childbirth. As Judy said, whatever he thinks can't be as bad as the truth. When we talked about why abortion had to be kept legal and accessible, Judy told us that as terrible as being molested has been for others, and it had been for her, being forced to stay pregnant, give birth against her will, that was far worse. This is what the anti-abortion movement wants: women, girls, to have to go through pregnancy and childbirths against their wills. We don't need to read Margaret Atwood to know what that might be like. There's living memory of 13-year-old girls tied to beds to keep them from killing themselves or aborting when they didn't want to carry. Now, friends, from friend of Passionate Justice writer Marsha G. Yerman, who last here shared about New Jersey's poorest kids and why they suffer most from pollution, she shares a new piece, Birds Tell an Urgent Climate Change Message. The canary in the coal mine, you know that phrase, has become part of our lexicon as a warning for danger. Now birds are cautioning humans about the imminent threat of global climate change, and the news is not good. Baltimore Orioles, not the ball club, may no longer be in Maryland by the end of the century, and that coastal species like the sandpiper, they're imperiled by rising sea levels. So I reached out to Gary Langham, Audubon Society's chief scientist, to learn more. He's got a PhD in ecology and evolutionary biology from Cornell. Audubon was founded 105 years ago, that society, by people alarmed by the slaughter of egrets being killed in order to supply women's hats with plumes. Audubon spearheaded the 1918 Migratory Bird Treaty Act, the first American law to protect birds from indiscriminate hunting. Langham told me that 588 species were examined within the context of how climate change would impact them by 2020, 2050, and 2080. Taking into account the consequences of greenhouse gases, 314 of 588 species, or 53%, are going to be highly impacted unless we recalibrate how we consume and generate energy. Having the longest-running animal census in the world since 1900, Audubon is uniquely and strategically positioned to contribute to the conversation. He discussed habitat shifts that evolved as a result of a changed landscape over the past century and a half, an outcome of humans converting land use to their own ends. Alarmingly, in the past 40 years, even common birds have declined 40 to 70% due to habitat shift. Langham underscored, birds have an urgent message. The reason they're on the move is climate change. It is. In the past two decades, more than 200 species have moved their habitat and their range substantially north in order to achieve comparable living conditions. This migration then impacts the ecosystems where they do resettle. He stressed disruption isn't good. Birds are an excellent indicator of nature overall. What impacts them will impact us. As the birds go, so do we. Restorative measures are the key. If we take concerted actions, birds can recover. He gave the example of the country's national emblem, our bald eagle, which was brought back from the brink after being devastated by the effects of DDT. Commenting on the newly elected representatives from Congress, Langham said that the fingerprints of big oil and gas are clearly evident, and they would be impacted terribly by projects like the XL pipeline. Langham asks us, contact the EPA, tell them we need protections, the birds do and so do we, from natural gas pollution, fracking, all of it. If you want to help, Google the Audubon Society and the Moms Clean Air Force. Wrapping today, have you had it with pop culture? Happy, happy, smiley, smiley advice and affirmations? Oh, I sure as hell have. So I call this, I'm too blessed to be stressed. The spongy black squishy balls battery had long since died when my hero son, knowing how much I enjoyed it when alive, performed the necessary resurrective surgery. And once again, the mood ball speaks. The mood ball was a gift given years ago to Tamar as a holiday gift from a sincere colleague who affirms whenever possible or impossible that God blesses sneezes, coughs, droughts, overripe cheese, mass starvations. God blesses pizza toppings, eczema, overpriced theater tickets, pinching maiden forms, tweens who mash ginkgo berries into your jockstrap like that. The mood ball, when squeezed, emits a woman's slightly nasally voice, calm yet assertive, not unlike the one you might imagine may belong to a faux cheery group leader at a 1970s Esalen offshoot or to a contemporary unlicensed life coach. Here's the mood ball's squozen advice, followed by my so sincere usual replies. I'm in control. The fuck you are. Nothing can ruin my day. Fuck your grandmother. No one can steal my joy. Fuck your joy. I'm not stressed. Fuck you're not. Balance is the key to a happy life. Really? Balance this. Count to 10, then fucking die. Tame your tension, tame this. Breathe before you speak. Go choke. Quiet the mind. Fuck your Aunt Bessie. Think positive. Go drop fucking dead. Relax, relax, relax. Yeah, you fucking relax. Make peace with imperfection. Make your peace right now. Practice patience. Really? Practice this. You're too blessed to be stressed. Oh, big fucking deal. Don't be your own worst critic. BFD again. Exercise. The powerful word, no. Fuck no. Have a nice day. Want to stop the creepy culture of forced affirmations and so much more? Follow the program on Twitter at jwolf41387. Keep trying to live as if happy, happy sayings don't really matter, but that justice, real justice matters, as if what your kids and you do matter. Be creative, courageous. Take your place on that great Mandela next to Bud Clayman, Kosh, Mary Lois, Mary Sears, Sean King, Angela, Majida, Marsha, and right next to me, because this is our brief moment of time. Phil Oakes did say, I guess I'll have to do it while I'm here, and you know he was right. Repair this crazy place. You can, I promise, when you act on justice's behalf. It will pay back, and it will most definitely make you happy for our 73rd show at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on the Starcom Radio and Satellite Network. And do right now, follow the show on Twitter at JWolf41387, because there and everywhere, it's passionate justice.
We gotta get out of this place.
Know it too.